Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And we're back into the content of the Virginia ratification debates. And I'm hoping that you're getting something out of this. As a matter of fact, we've got Paul, and Paul's back with us. And one of the things that we kind of, you know, I'll just say glossed over maybe, was this concept when we look at the Madison made a comment regarding the parties to the compact. And I'm actually looking for it. And because this is his famous June 6th, and it's actually in underneath the enumerated jurisdiction and confederalism. And he's responding. It's unfortunately, I didn't highlight this before, Paul. So welcome back, by the way. And so this is what he says. He says, who are the parties to it? He's talking about the Constitution. Who are the parties to the compact? He says, the people, but not the people as composing of one great body, but the people as composing 13 sovereignties. And so he's identifying that the party is really the states. And the reason it's the states, and he doesn't get into this as good as I think it would have really helped people understand, that when you look at government and you look at, you know, the parties to it, that's really not the people at all, because the people are mortal. People die. The state is perpetual. The county is perpetual. So when you say the people today, it's not the people back then. It's now a different set of people. But the one thing that has remained constant, it is the sovereignty of the state. And so the people delegate the power to the state, just like the people actually, and I kind of covered this, I think, yesterday, that when the people create, and it may have been a phone call, when the people actually create their county, that is where the people are the closest to a democratic form in this republic. Does that make sense?
Of course it does.
Because
representatives.
Right, because you don't have a government above that. In other words, you don't have, you know, a sub-government underneath that. Now, you can, and I think I talked about this, that you, if you live in a really populated county, then you could get to a point where that county should be broken down into subdivisions, which they would call districts. And the district would then, you know, you'd have enough districts, because I know in Spokane, they have like, I think, five. Spokane Valley, Spokane County has five districts. And they're not that populated like Seattle or some of these other bigger cities where the population density is just really through the roof. So how do you, because the precincts are still the same size. You know, the precinct is the smallest element of our political structure. Mm-hmm. That's how we vote. And that's how, you know, the parties basically build upon precincts. And so I think, you know, I'm going to guess the average precinct is somewhere around 1,000 to 1,500, something like that, as far as voters. And so it's a very small subset within your county. And if you have a really high population center, then you have a lot of precincts. And so grouping them into districts where you'd now be able to break down your county to where you should be able to have representation, the people of that district have representation. And then if you have some sub element of organization, because, you know, the parties typically break the districts down into having a chair that sits over that district, and they're organized that way. Well, if we actually got rid of the party and we actually only had the people in a governing fashion, you could actually have a district leader that would be a political, you know, I would even venture to say that you could have a small executive committee at a district level to where the executive committee could actually appoint a senator to represent them, and that the people would vote for a representative as a commissioner. Does that make sense?
Ah, right.
In other words, okay. You know, the whole point of this government was to have checks and balances. And the only place that you don't have the checks and balances of a bicameral legislative body is at the county level.
Sure.
Because you don't have any sub-government to actually make sure you have representation that really protects the interest of your district. Because the way districts are carved out of a county, they could have very distinct different interests. And, you know, I always use the shoreline, like King County has, you know, the Puget Sound or the, you know, the waterline. And then they have other areas. And a part of those areas are maybe agricultural, maybe industrial or what have you. And so the interests of those areas should have, you know, some equal voice in breaking that county down. That way you have these checks and balances to ensure that those who are really concerned about, you know, the interest of the district more so than the interest of the people. And that way, you know, you can actually have some checks and balances, and creating a bicameral legislative body at the county level.
Well, let me, how do you, here's one that I'm wondering how we would deal with, and it's come to mind. I haven't thought of it, but let me give you an example. Two cities that I'm familiar with. Kansas City pours into about four counties. Columbus, Ohio pours into about 11. So you have city government, and then you've got county government. And of course, some cities or some areas within a county or outside city limits, et cetera. But what do you do when you have a city that covers territory in multiple counties?
Well, actually, I think a better example, one of the best examples, would be Atlanta. Atlanta okay. probably covers, I'm going to say, maybe 20 counties. Wow. Because the counties are very small there.
Okay.
And so what I would suggest, what I would basically say, is that those counties, because I would look at the districts, you know, or the precincts, because I believe the counties. So the reason why Georgia is this small, and some people don't understand this, was Georgia was mapped out by the originally by those who framed it in building it by 10-acre lots.
Okay.
And it was basically the colony for those who were let out of the penal colony, you know, out of prison in the UK, in Britain, right? Because these were basically you know, white collar crime. They weren't violent criminals, but they were people that, you know, hey, if you want to actually, you know, have a shot at, you know, indentured, because you're already a prisoner here, will allow you to work off and you can have 10 acres in Georgia. So Georgia was built that way. And the reason was built that way so that it had a higher density of population, because in the Carolinas, they had huge 100, 200 large plantations that either people came in to buy or people came in as indentured servants. And most of the indentured servants in the previous colonies were getting like 100 acres of land just to go and work off their time. And so then they...
when they're done?
I'm sorry, what was that?
And then they get to keep the land when they're done?
Well, so they're given the land when they're done working on the plantation. And so then they can have, you know, a set of, because now you can bring in more indentured servants to serve the land and those people that have obtained their land. And that's how they grew it, so that, you know, they kept on maintaining. So the first inn usually had a pretty well-developed plantation, and they usually would take more and more. And so that's how the, you know, the first families coming in had the, became the ones with the advantages.
Right.
Because they, you know, they were in there first and they were able to take and gobble up a little bit more land and expand on their plantation and their estate. And as they carved out land for other people, then it got less and less and less. But anyway, Georgia was done the way it was, to create a denser population so that if Spain decided to come up and attack the colonies, Georgia would be the first to, you know, to be in its sights. And mm-hmm. because of the denser population, there would be a greater likelihood that Georgia would find out that, you know, Spain is moving north to attack. In other words, they were like a buffer zone. Almost like a demilitarized zone,
right? And of course, they the way the colonies understood militia, they probably had a militia, you know, ready to take action.
Yes. Okay. So when we look at how, you know, these counties in Atlanta were built, there's probably something to be said in consolidating those counties into a larger county to encompass, you know, logically either a part of the city, you know, because the city does have areas, you know, you have, in some ways they call them like districts, right? They have, you know, Chinatown and, you know, places where there are really distinctive differences. And so it wouldn't hurt my head that they would either break the city down into, you know, or consolidate the counties either into one, you know, to accommodate the city, which would be best. But, you know, Atlanta is a big city. It's a spread out city. But this would be an opportunity, because I know that there are counties like Fulton County wants to really break away from, or actually, I don't know if it's Fulton. I think Eric could talk about that, but not long story short, you know, there's ways to do that. There's ways to manage that so that you actually, you know, can provide the services, because you have a city, court system, right? And that basically deals with the city laws.
Okay.
And the county court deals with the county and state laws.
Right.
And so, you know, the superior court would be the county court, right?
The superior court would be the county court?
Yes.
And not the state court?
In relationship to the city.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. All right. So anyway, I think there's a way to do that. But see, here's the problem. And this kind of goes down the line of the military. You know, what ends up happening when you have lots of counties? That means you have lots of judges. You have lots of sheriffs. Mm-hmm. And nobody wants to be consolidated to say, well, we're going to have one county court, you know, as we combine all of these counties, you can actually cut down your court costs in Georgia.
Mm.
You can now cut down your law enforcement costs, because you're not going to have eight, you know, sheriffs in this area. You're now going to have one sheriff.
Okay.
Which means that you're paying, you know, when you're paying top dollar for all of these different judges and sheriffs, you know, it actually saves you money, because you're not paying that. You're still going to be paying for the same amount of heads, but you just don't have the top end structure. And the judges, that's a huge cost.
Right.
Right. Right.
That's interesting.
It is. It is.
Wow. Okay.
This actually goes to prove how we have like to grow government for government's sake, not for the people's sake. And when we want to actually save money, the best thing we can do is shrink government to basically give it a proportion. Now, there's this crap going on in Atlanta, you know, in the news and all of that, you know, with the protests. But that's the way we need to go. We really do need to actually downsize government's involvement and increase the people's involvement. In other words, reactivate the militias and so forth. And I'm going to be getting into that in the presidential episodes coming up. But let us turn back to where we left off. And let's go to that last note under this long oration of Madison. And this is where he starts off with, but it is urged that it is consolidated nature. Go ahead.
Okay, I got it. But it is urged that its consolidated nature, joined to the power of direct taxation, will give it a tendency to destroy all subordinate authority, that its increasing influence will speedily enable it to absorb the state governments. I cannot think this will be the case. If the general government were wholly independent of the governments of the particular states, then indeed usurpation might be expected to the fullest extent. But, sir, on whom does this general government depend? It derives its authority from these governments and from the same sources from which their authority is derived. The members of the federal government are taken from the same men from whom those of the state legislatures are taken. If we consider the mode in which the federal representatives will be chosen, we shall be convinced that the general will never destroy the individual governments, and this conviction must be strengthened by an attention to the construction of the Senate. The representatives will be chosen probably under the influence of the members of the state legislatures, but there is not the least probability that the election of the latter will be influenced by the former. 160 members represent this commonwealth in one branch of the legislature, are drawn from the people at large, and must ever possess more influence than the few men who will be elected to the general legislature. The reasons offered on this subject by a gentleman on the same side, Mr. Nicholas, were unanswerable and have been so full that I shall add but little more on the subject. Those who wish to become federal representatives must depend on their credit with that class of men who will be the most popular in their counties.
Okay, so I highlighted that.
Right.
So it wasn't legislative or congressional districts. These things were broken down by counties.
Right. Okay.
Okay. Go ahead. Keep going. Great job.
Who generally represent the people in the state governments. They can therefore never succeed in any measure contrary to the wishes of those on whom they depend. It is almost certain, therefore, that the deliberations of the members of the federal House of Representatives will be directed to the interest of the people of America. As to the other branch, the senators will be appointed by the legislatures. And though elected for 6 years, I do not conceive they will so soon forget the source from which they derive their political existence. This election of one branch by the state legislatures secures an absolute dependence of the former on the latter. The biennial exclusion of one third will lessen the facility of a combination and may put a stop to intrigues. I appeal to your past experience, whether they will attend to the interests of their constituent states. Have not those gentlemen who have been honored with seats in Congress often signalized themselves by their attachment to their seats? I wish this government may answer the expectation of its friends and foil the apprehension of its enemies. I hope the patriotism of the people will continue and be a sufficient guard to their liberties. I believe its tendency will be that the state governments will counteract the general interest and ultimately prevail. The number of the representatives is yet sufficient for our safety and will gradually increase. And if we consider their different sources of information, the number will not appear too small.
Okay, so he kind of closes out with that wish. And as I was listening to this, he basically is aligning and laying out a system that if we would have adhered to the system of maintaining representation and complying to the Constitution, that we would actually foil the intrigues and the machinations of our enemies. And this is what he says. He says, I wish this government may answer the expectation of its friends and foil the apprehension of its enemies. And it actually does the way it works, which is why the enemies had to attack our framework, our actual layout, why Reynolds v. Sims and Baker v. Carr, those two cases, along with a few others, and basically annihilating the counties and our Republican form of government, where right. we no longer had true checks and balances within our state government. They moved us away from this model into a democracy, which is the greatest peril. And this is what's really put us on, I would say, steroids since the 60s towards right. our demise.
Correct.
Okay. So anyway, any other takeaways on your own?
Not at the moment. I think we are on Mr. Nicholas now.
Yes, right? We are. And so now Nicholas picks up, right? And as a matter of fact, Madison just referenced him in the very last paragraph there, that the other gentleman on the same side, Mr. Nicholas. And so now this is what he's going to basically say. And this is where he actually talks about, I believe, the commission. But go ahead.
Okay. This is Mr. Nicholas. Mr. Chairman, if the resolution taken by the House of going regularly through the system clause by clause had been followed, I should confine myself to one particular paragraph. But as to my surprise, the debates have taken a different turn.
Stop here. If right here, he's actually calling out everybody for violating the agreement of how they were going to go through the Constitution. And the anti-federalists actually just started highlighting all of the problems, hopping all over the place, and basically trying to divert going through this thing systematically.
Okay.
Okay,
but
go ahead.
But as to my surprise, the debates have taken a different turn. I shall endeavor to go through the principal parts of the argument made use of by the gentleman in opposition to the proposed plan of government. The worthy gentleman entertained us very largely on the impropriety and dangers of the powers given by this plan to the general government, but his argument appears to me inconclusive and inaccurate. It amounts to this, that the powers given to any government ought to be small. I believe this, sir, is a new idea in politics. Powers being given for some certain purpose ought to be proportionate to that purpose, or else the end for which they are delegated will not be answered. It is necessary to give powers to a certain extent to any government. If a due medium be not observed in the delegation of such powers, one of two things must happen. If they be too small, the government must molder and decay away. If too extensive, the people must be oppressed. As there can be no liberty without government, it must be as dangerous to make powers too limited as too great. Now, that's interesting. He says, for my anarchist friends, as there can be no liberty without government.
Right. That's right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm just taking
Hey, Paul. Paul, we're going to go into a break, so this is a perfect time. We're going to go straight into the intermission or the mid promo. So hold on, and we are going to be right back after this one promo, and then we'll dive into the commission part. So, folks, stay tuned. We'll be right back after this. The reason
reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, health care, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org and go to the contributions page, and you can become a listed supporter of liberty. Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay. Excuse me. So we're coming into his next, I'll say, backhand. And this is where he actually talks about the necessity of what had to happen in the federal convention. And so go ahead and take it from he tells us.
Okay. He tells us that the Constitution annihilates the Confederation. Did he not prove that every people had a right to change their government when it should be deemed inadequate to their happiness? The Confederation being found utterly defective, will he deny our right to alter or abolish it? But he objects to this expression, we the people, and demands the reason why they had not said we the United States of America. I think I know who he's talking about. Was this Patrick Henry?
Yep, because this was why I highlighted that first part from Madison when we got started, how
right.
Madison pointed out, who's the parties to it? We the people? Not we the people as one body, but we the people of 13 sovereign states. Yep.
Correct.
Okay.
Because I remember a reference in which Patrick Henry was seeing red when he saw the words we the people. Okay. So anyway, in my opinion, the expression is highly proper. It is submitted to the people because on them it is to operate. Till adopted, it is but a dead letter and not binding on any one. When adopted, it becomes binding on the people who adopt it. It is proper on another account. We are under great obligations to the Federal Convention for recurring to the people the source of all power. The gentleman's argument militates against himself. He says that persons in power never relinquish their powers willingly. If then the state legislatures would not relinquish part of the powers they now possess to enable a general government to support the union, reference to the people is necessary. We are in the next place frightened by two sets of collectors who, he tells us, will oppress us with impunity. The amount of the sums to be raised of the people is the same, whether the state legislatures lay the taxes for themselves or for the general government, whether each of them lays and collects taxes for its own exclusive purposes. The manner of raising it only is different so far as the amount of the impost may exceed that of the present collections. So much will the burdens of the people be less. Money cannot be raised in a more judicious manner than by imposts. It is not felt by the people. It is a mode which is practiced by many nations. 9/10 of the revenues of Great Britain and France are raised by indirect taxes, and were they raised by direct taxes, they would be exceedingly oppressive. At present, the reverse of this proposition holds in this country, for very little is raised by indirect taxes. For the benefit of the audience, we may have done this before.
Yeah.
He's using the term imposts. I'm
right.
Emphasizing that these are indirect. Could you clarify that for us?
Yeah, so imposts are taxes placed on imports. Yes. In other words, commodities coming in from another nation, we place a tax on that, and that's what funds the government. Direct taxes are taxes that are levied It's an income tax. A direct tax is a tax that's directly levied. You have to pay this. Like a poll tax is a direct tax.
Or, and he's making it, right, okay.
Or the Constitution actually refers to it as a duty.
Okay.
Right? Because if you want to vote, you have a duty. They called it duty because, you know, you have an obligation to pay for your government. And so if you want to vote in it, you have a duty or a duty tax, which is a direct tax. A duty is a direct tax. An impost is a tax placed upon the goods coming into America. Excise taxes are taxes that are placed on consumables. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay. And he makes a point here of pointing out how direct taxes and indirect taxes affect the people.
Right. And he's actually talking about how most nations actually make most of their money on imposts. The reason why the Confederation couldn't do that is because, you know, they had no control over the importation of goods, and they had no control over the, this is how all of the states were bypassing the Confederation, creating their own trade agreements.
Mm-hmm.
And so with this Constitution, they were actually changing the direction, because he was right here. He was saying that the money that they're receiving right now are direct taxes. Right.
Okay.
Okay.
So I think the next thing, I think we're done with that. The next thing looks like there's a note for Article 5.
Yep. Right? And you have to kind of go down to the top of the next page. Yeah.
I'm there.
Okay.
So the worthy member has exclaimed with uncommon vehemence against the mode provided for securing amendments. He thinks amendments can never be obtained because so great a number is required to concur. Had it rested solely with Congress, there might have been danger. The committee will see that there is another mode provided besides that which originated with Congress. On the application of the legislatures of 2/3 of the several states, a convention is to be called to propose amendments, which shall be a part of the Constitution when ratified by the legislatures of 3/4 of the several states, or by conventions in 3/4 thereof. It is not to conclude that those states who will apply for calling the convention will concur in the ratification of the proposed amendments. So he's pointing out here that not only are there 2/3 have to call it, but 3/4 have to ratify it, which I guess he's pointing out is kind of a check and balance there, right?
Yeah, you still can't have a bunch of rogue states actually changing it, the threshold of making something constitutional requires right. 3/4 of the parties to agree.
Right.
Okay.
I think that was truly wisdom that has helped us in our day. So there are strong and cogent reasons operating in my mind that the amendments which shall be agreed to by those states will be sooner ratified by the rest than any other than can be proposed. The conventions which shall be so called will have their deliberations confined to a few points. No local interest to divert their attention, nothing but the necessary alterations. They will have many advantages over the last convention. No experiments to devise, the general and fundamental regulations being already laid down.
Okay. Now he jumps and changes subject, and he goes into a dispelling of martial law.
Okay. Martial law. But it is complained that they may suspend our laws. The suspension of the writ of habeas corpus is only to take place in cases of rebellion or invasion. This is necessary in those cases. In every other case, Congress is restrained from suspending it. In no other case can they suspend our laws.
So let me jump in here.
Yeah.
The suspension of the writ of habeas corpus is only to take place in the cases of rebellion or invasion.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, they have the ability to do that, but they're going to actually in June 14th timeframe. They're going to actually requalify this even further by saying that martial law will only be called in the area that's being affected.
Right. Okay.
Go ahead.
Interesting. Okay. And this is the most estimable security. But the influence in New England and the other northern states is dreaded. There are apprehensions of their combining against us, not to advert to the improbability and illiberality of this idea. It must be supposed that our population will, in a short period, exceed theirs, as their country is well settled, and we have very extensive uncultivated tracts. We shall soon outnumber them in as great a degree as they do us at this time. Therefore, this government, which I trust will last to the remotest ages, will be very shortly in our favor. Treason consists in levying war against the United States, or in adhering to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort. The punishment of this well-defined crime is to be declared by Congress. No oppression, therefore, can arise on this ground. This security does away the objection that the most grievous oppressions might happen under color of punishing crimes against the general government. The limitation of the forfeiture to the life of the criminal is also an additional privilege.
So a little bit here to, you know, to dive into, but his speculation, all things being equal, that if America moved forward in an agrarian nature, then the southern states, or the eastern states, as they call them, which is, you know, New England, that they, because they are out of land.
Right.
And so the southern state has so much more land that they will outpopulate them. Mm-hmm. One thing that he wasn't calculating was the advent of industry and factories.
Okay.
And so look at what ended up happening. What was the most populated area of the United States for quite a while?
It wound up being New England.
It actually was New England, absolutely. Or I should say the northern states, from New York up. Even New Jersey started really getting populated as a spillover for New York. Mm-hmm. And so it didn't, some of these things just didn't pan out, but they were basically living under this paradigm that America was and was to be an agrarian society. They didn't realize an industrial revolution was just in the winds coming.
Right.
Right. Okay.
Okay.
So now we go down to Saturday on June 7th, and Mr. Corbin makes an interesting comment regarding interposition. Go ahead.
Okay. Tell me where it is, because I have nothing marked for Mr. Corbin.
Okay. You see Saturday, June 7th, right?
I'm in it, and I'm in Mr. Corbin, and I am looking for highlights.
So it should be at the top of your, what's the page, 62? And it would be the paragraph kind of at the top of that. It starts off with, "The honorable gentleman is possessed of much historical knowledge."
It's possessed, 62. All right, just a minute. I'm going there.
All right, so
I'll find it.
You know what? I'll go ahead and read this.
Okay.
"The honorable gentleman is possessed of much historical knowledge. I appeal to that knowledge, therefore. Will he not agree that there is a coercive power in the federal government of the amphitheonics?"
Amphitheonics, it looks like it says.
Yeah, so the coercive power of the amphitheonics council, it was so great as to enable it to punish disobedience and refractory behavior in the most severe manner. Is there not an instance of this carrying fire and sword through the territories and leveling to the ground the towns of those who disobey it? Here, Mr. Corbyn mentions particular instances. Is there no coercion in the Germanic body? This body, though composed of 300 different component sovereignties, principalities, and cities, and divided into nine circles, is controlled by one superintending power, the emperor. Is there no coercive power in the Confederate government of the Swiss? In the alliance between the France, or in the alliance between them and France, there's a provision whereby the latter is to interpose and settle differences that may arise among them. And this interposition has been more than once used. Is there none in Holland? What is the stakeholder? The power is necessary in all governments. A superintending coercive power is absolutely indispensable. This does not exist under the present Articles of Confederation. To vest it with such power on its present construction without any alteration would be extremely dangerous and might actually lead to civil war. The gentleman must, before this, have been conceived of the necessity of an alteration. Our state vessel has sprung a leak. We must embark in a new bottom or sink to perdition. Mm-hmm. Now, so he's talking about how, you know, there's this ability for somebody in government or some form of government to interpose, you know, to step in from the tyranny that is being levied by the state. Now, he's talking about Swiss has an agreement with France that if this, if the Swiss people, you know, become so engulfed in, or the Swiss government gets so engulfed in actually being oppressive, then France has been identified as the entity to come in and interpose. Interpose being stepping in and using, sure, you know, the political forces necessary to actually get the people to, or get the government out of the people's knickers. And it was the same thing with the, but the emperor was the, you know, the controller of that, who could, I guess, interpose among these circles of government within the Germanic states. And in America, the Confederation or the federal government, the general government, didn't have the power to kind of interpose with insurrections, because the whole point of the federal government was to specifically protect the state's sovereignty from rebellion from within, invasions, and to ensure the execution of the laws.
Right.
Okay, so that was the point there. And there was the necessary power for the federal government to possess to be able to do that on behalf of the people of the states. Because I've said this over and over and over again. Who are the bad players in government in America? The states.
Okay.
The states were the ones that were always being manipulative. And, you know, the states, you know, as they had these key representatives of the political power class, like Henry and so forth, Clinton up in New York, here were a bunch of people that were just trying to protect their power, you know, to control their own people. And they didn't want to give that up. And I have said that when it came to the Bill of Rights, the only government entity that was really guilty of violating the Bill of Rights previously was the states.
Right.
And, you know, there wasn't a lot of history where there were, you know, many cases coming up that where the federal government was violating anything within the Bill of Rights.
The federal government didn't have that much influence.
That's right.
Based
on the Constitution, they still don't.
Right.
They got, and what ended up happening was the federal government got the states to become the agents. After the Organic Act of 1871, the federal government got the states to actually do their bidding, you know, their bad bidding for them.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is how states have become, you know, these vestiges of of tyranny, where we see these blue states completely turning their back on the Constitution, and you know how they have, you know, gun laws that absolutely take away your right to have a gun. They can't do that. But they're doing it, and the federal government is actually supporting that. Well, until, you know, Scalia and some others actually said, hey, you can't do that.
Right.
Right.
Okay.
Right. So go ahead. And this is where we talk. Governor Randolph himself talks about money.
Okay. Now, I see Governor Randolph. Let's see. I see. Now, I have a sheriff's. So
let me cover the money one, because what I need to do is I need to send this updated one to you, because these are some new categories that we have. Money is the nerve, the life and soul of government. It is the utmost folly to say that a government could be carried on without this great agent of human affairs. Wars cannot be carried on without a full and uncontrolled discretion power to raise money in an eligible manner. Nay, sir, government cannot be administered in time of peace without this power. For how is it to be done? It is needless to impress any further on the minds of the gentlemen to hear me the necessity of this power in governments. If so, ought the general government be more circumscribed in the power of providing for its own safety and existence to any other government? Ought it not depend for the means of its preservation on other bodies? This is actually the case with the Confederation. The power of raising money was nominally vested in that system. In March 1781, when Maryland, the most backward state then, conceded that Congress should have the power of receiving and demanding their proportionate quotas of the states, this was an acknowledgement of the necessity of vesting a power in Congress to raise such sums as emergencies might require. But the means which were proposed have been inadequate to compass the end. The propriety of this means it is alone disputed. No doubt it is universal opinion of the people of this Commonwealth that its legislature should have the power of raising money at its own will and pleasure. There are two ways whereby this may be effected: by requisitions or taxation. There is no other manner, for it surpasses the ingenuity of man to devise any other mode of raising money than by one of these two methods. If the alternative of requisitions be determined as more eligible, it will not avail without coercion. If that of taxation be preferred, it will be sufficient without coercion. If our legislature were to depend on requisitions for money to answer the ends of government, then, sir, the absurdity and sophistry of the arguments urged in defense of such a mode of procuring money would strike the weakest intellect. If the mere pleasure of the individuals were alone to be consulted, if it were left to the choice of your people to pay or not, your treasury would be much poorer than it is, and the advocates of this pernicious policy would perhaps be ashamed of their pernicity. Suppose for a moment that only existing mode of raising revenue in Virginia to be that of requisitions. Suppose your requisitions sent on to every county say that the money is wanted, assume the most pressing language, quote, "We earnestly entreat you, we humbly supplicate and solicit you, would furnish us with 1,000 or 100 pounds to defray necessary charges of our government." Close quote. What would be the result of such applications for voluntary contributions? You would be laughed at for your folly, for thinking human nature could be thus operated. From my knowledge of human nature and my countrymen, I am perfectly certain that this would be the case. In other words, you know, who's actually going to be willing to pay a request. Government comes along and says, could you kindly give us some money?
Right.
That's not how government can even operate. And so that's how the Continental Congress was operating. And so they had to have what we defer to as more coercive means. So now he proceeds on and on, and now he makes some comments regarding the sheriff.
Okay. I'm there.
Okay. Go ahead.
Let us consider this dispassionately, and whether the idea be well-founded, which is suggested that a conflict will frequently happen between the state and congressional collector for property seized and claimed by both. If there be no necessity or strong temptation to increase the present number of officers, no addition will be made to them. Congress will have every inducement, and from the mode of their appointment must be inclined to lighten the burdens of the people. They can derive no advantage from a contrary conduct. In other countries, where the fate of the poor is wretched, officers are created merely for the emolument of certain individuals. But by the structure of this government, the interests of the people must always be considered, nor will any but necessary officers be created. The number of officers and their compensations will be as inconsiderable as the nature of their business will admit of. With respect to collectors of the general taxes, I have not the least doubt that Congress will employ the state officers and sheriffs because it will be economical and agreeable to the people, and considerable sum will be saved by it. They will employ such men, Mr. Chairman, unless they determine to throw away the public money in an unjustifiable manner. I've got a question.
Yes. Go ahead.
They seem to have the understanding that the sheriffs were the tax collectors.
Yes, and who was the tax collectors in Britain?
Oh, that was the sheriff.
There you right? go. And this is a government that basically, you know, spawned the British paradigm. And so the sheriffs had more of a role of collecting taxes, yeah, and running elections.
So
you got to remember, and we've talked about this, that in the British system, they had this doctrine of the lesser magistrate.
Right.
Okay, so the lesser magistrate already existed and still exists in the Confederation. They didn't wipe it out by demanding a republican form of government in each state and a reconfiguration of government to create three bodies of government, executive, judiciary, and legislative. Okay. And so the states, and actually a bicameral legislative. And so they now really had to go out, and if this Constitution was going to be ratified, it would force a change of the states, and that's what happened. Because we already covered that many of the states were unicameral legislative mm-hmm. bodies.
Right.
And we know now, as we've just ran out of time, Paul, so we'll have to come back on this, but folks, we know now that after the Constitution was ratified, every state reconfigured itself where the counties became the sub-element of government and the repository of political power in the states. Folks, we'll be covering this right back tomorrow. We'll be picking it up where we left off. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcast and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Mobiusstrip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Mobiusstrip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you.